You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds pass right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Major Tyson Walsh, thanks so much for joining us for this episode of The Spear.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about a story from 2013. You know, our regular listeners will know that we usually kind of talk about a little bit of background first. And I have to say, I'm quite certain that you are the first guest that we've had on here that is a graduate of
the Merchant Marine Academy.
The Merchant Marine Academy. Talk about that. How did you end up in the Army after the Merchant Marine Academy?
That's a good question. I went to high school at the New Mexico Military Institute, which is in Roswell, New Mexico, middle of nowhere. It's a wannabe West Point. It's, you know, West Point Junior. And did most of my high school there. Got in some trouble. Got suspended. But quickly recovered, got accepted into all the academies except Coast Guard. And so I had my choice, and I looked into the Merchant Marine Academy, and they said, listen, you graduate from here, you get this Coast Guard license. I didn't really understand what that meant because there's no water in New Mexico. but you get a choice of active duty, National Guard, Reserve, and then any service. So you want to go Air Force Reserve. Done. If you want to go active army, done. So if you change your mind up to the last, they do trimesters, even in the last trimester, if you were going active duty Marine Corps and you had a ground contract and you suddenly decide, like I did, I want to go infantry in the Army because it's guaranteed, they say, sure, you know, welcome aboard.
So that's what happened. That's how you ended up in the Army from the Merchant Marine Academy.
And it was actually a West Point graduate, Joel Bafardi, and his sergeant, his NCO, Peter Swiderski, they convinced me that the Army is a little bit of the same flavor as the Marine Corps, but if I did poorly at TBS in the Marine Corps, you know, even if you have one bad day, you go from a straight infantry contract and they reclass you to ground intel, field artillery, logistics, you know, they get that choice. Whereas with the Army, you branch what you branch, mm-hmm. and then they post you, you know, based off of that, how you do it, IBOLIC or Ranger School, etc. And so they guaranteed me Fort Carson Infantry, and I high-fived them on the way out the door, and it's like a dream come true. I couldn't believe it.
So when did you get to Fort Carson?
After an attempt at Ranger School, I went to Fort Carson in May of 2009.
Okay.
That's when I was assigned.
And as a platoon leader?
Platoon leader. I was branched infantry, but they put us all wherever we could fit. They wanted us in platoon slots immediately, so I went straight to an armor platoon.
Okay.
It's a little over 2 years in the same platoon. Second platoon, Charlie Company, 166 armor, 1st Brigade, 4th ID. It's fantastic.
What was that like to be an infantry guy and then suddenly say, hey, here's your tank platoon?
It was pretty awesome.
Was it?
So I'd heard about tanks, had seen a couple movies with tanks. And then when you see the guys in action and they pull that first round out and it comes nearly up to your waist and then they shoot that sucker, I mean, that's serious power. When all you've seen up to that point is maybe an AT-4, maybe a 240 Bravo, seeing a 120, you know, millimeter round go off is pretty epic.
And did you deploy with that platoon?
So I did. So they ran through an entire tank gunnery, and we were tracking for Iraq. That the incident in Haiti happened. They needed recovery personnel there, so they sent the 82nd there. And we took the 82nd's mission in Afghanistan. Complete reversal of roles. So we put away all the vehicles. No Humvees, nothing. No tanks, nothing. No Bradleys. Went to Afghanistan completely light with tankers.
Wow.
And we did a great job.
That's good.
My men were awesome.
And then you come back from that first deployment.
Come back, hit up EIB, and immediately go to career course with my peers and some of the people in the class ahead of me. Get through career course, kind of take a knee there, and then try Ranger School again. No go again. And then head to the lovely Fort Polk. I had a choice between Fort Campbell and Fort Polk because I put Fort Polk second. They said he must really want Fort Polk. So to 410 I went.
So and I think, you know, some people will know this, some listeners maybe, but so you went to you have a combat patch, 10th Mountain Division combat patch, 10th Mountain Division, you know, winter training up at Fort Drum, New York. But when they created the 4th Brigade in, I think it was 2006-07, essentially,
right,
to support the surge in Iraq, they put them at Fort Polk in the swamp. What was that like?
That was everything you hear bad about Fort Polk, mainly about the weather and the insects, is pretty well substantiated. So it was tough. It was good training. I mean, you're right there at JRTC. You get to work, you know, arms linked together with OP4, with Geronimo, with the 509th. You see the training grounds that you're about to be tested on out there in JRTC during rotations. And the soldiers they send you are very wide range. So we get guys, I had soldiers that were 18 X-ray dropouts that just didn't make it through RASP, that didn't make it through Ranger, that didn't make it through any part of the Q course. They would wash out and they would show up at Fort Polk. And then you had guys that like couldn't finish airborne school. And so you get this wide range of soldiers. You never know what you're going to get. Unlike somewhere at Fort Bragg where there's a certain quality of soldier you are expecting.
Sure. So we were talking before we started recording. My first deployment was with a unit that was in support of 410. And so my combat patch is the 10th Mountain Division combat patch. And there have been times when I've been wearing it some other place and somebody will, you know, roll down the window in their car as they drive by and yell, "Climb to glory." And, I had to tell them, well, I was actually a unit in support of them. And also it was the Fort Polk part of the 10th Mountain Division. So what about unit culture? Because, you know, if you wear the same patch and you're all at Drum, there is this sort of, like I said, climb to glory culture about it. Did you feel a part of that, or were you more a part of the sort of Fort Polk culture?
It was interesting. So there was a lot of unit pride within our brigade, and even more so at
sort
the
of brigade pride,
right? A lot of brigade pride, a lot of battalion pride, and something really interesting happened. So I was at Fort Polk for 4 straight years. And my last few months there, they brought back this old idea from, it must have been 20 years prior, to repatch standalone brigades with kind of sister National Guard units.
Yep.
So they switched out our patch with the Texas T. And I thought, you know, I had that same mindset. Well, we're 10th Mountain, but we're like our own thing at Fort Polk. We're the Fort Polk Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this won't really affect our unit culture. It really did.
Really?
I mean, there a lot of, not so much with the officers, or at least with the, you know, the captains and above, but even at the E7 level and the lieutenant level and below, the guys were pissed. They didn't want to wear some National Guard patch. They wanted to wear their 10th Mountain patch. They had a lot of, suddenly there was a lot of division pride.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you're there at Fort Polk and the unit deploys to Afghanistan again in, when was this, 2013?
They did a deployment 11-12 in the Tangi, mostly in the Tangi Valley up in RC East. And that was rough. That's where you had the 31 Heroes event,
yeah.
All that. Then they came back, reset really quick, and we shot out again, once again to RC East, spread out with this advising mission, this security forces advise and assist teams. And that was in 2013, summer of 2013.
Okay. So where specifically in Afghanistan were you?
So 230 was further east of us. They were at Torkham Gate. And 24, we had Fob Tagab in Kapisa province.
Okay.
And Fob Tagab is this beautiful, you know, former French fob. Massive. Massive fob. And we had this tiny little corner because most of it had been transitioned to the Afghans.
What's it? This is your second time in Afghanistan.
Second time.
Where were you the first time?
The first time I was in RC South, okay, in Kandahar, in the Arghandab River Valley.
Okay. So RC South, you're at least in the kind of the northern part of Kandahar where you get some terrain features. Lots of Kandahar province, Helmand province is just completely flat. But
right
now you're in something that's a kind of a different order of magnitude, right? What was the terrain like in the area that you were in?
So in RC South, flat, and then you could see the mountains in the distance.
Sure.
And there was only one mountain, Kop Kuhak, was near it. And they had their OP on top of it. And that was really it. Fob Tagab, there was mountains behind us, mountains in front of us. And everywhere we advised, mountains there too. Naglu, Naglu High, Naglu Low, everywhere. There was very mountainous.
Okay. And it's an advisory mission. So you're going out often, but it's always with a partner unit, presumably. What was your job at the time?
So I was the, not only was I the battalion, 2-4 Infantry's battalion AS3, I was also one of the SFAT team members.
Okay.
And so I was advising an S3 officer in the Afghan National Army.
Wow. Okay, so you are, I mean, this is the spear, so we're going to hear a combat story. When are we talking about?
So December 1st, 2013.
How long had you been in country?
Like 7 months, 6-7 months.
Long enough for everything to kind of become normal.
Right.
Feel a sense of comfort with your job and the environment and things.
You'd think so. So we had this unfortunate event happen, this kind of knee-jerk reaction, I like to call it. There was a report, and it was substantiated because there was an event similar to this report, so it was a second of its kind. It was a semi-truck VBID. And so it was kind of a laughing matter, kind of comical when we heard it, until we realized that there actually was one prior that had detonated and created like a moon crater outside of a cop. And so they said, well, now there's another one. And even though the pictures they used that they showed us this thing, it was they showed us a transportation vehicle full of landmines, and it's because they didn't have an actual picture of a truck VBID.
Sure.
So we kind of like rolled our eyes, but the threat was pretty serious, and they said, any of these little tiny standalone advising units, you need to get out. You need to close what little piece of terrain you have down and move somewhere where there's better force protection. Because our main force protection for, you know, three sides of our compound was the Afghans. And they were, I mean, they had tanks, but they were a little, I don't know, little death blossomy, I guess you could say.
Sure. So three sides of the compound for your team?
For 2-4 infantry. And we had a couple of ODAs,
okay,
inside of it.
Okay. So this is on Tagab.
On Fob Tagab.
Okay.
So they shut that down and we moved. And it was like record breaking time. Our force protection Alpha Company 2-4's XO and team coordinated and shut down this cop. That's a little compound with like record time. So in a matter of a few days,
yeah,
we got the heck out of there, convoyed all of our junk, all of our equipment, all of our men and vehicles and women over to Bagram, to Baff.
Wow.
And they weren't ready for us.
So, which is impressive because, you know, we just ran an episode, and we've done a couple about the Battle of Kop Keating.
Right.
And if anybody has read Jake Tapper's book, Outpost, where they have, you know, there was a series of these outposts in that part of Afghanistan that it was months that they were kind of talking about, should we close it? Can we close it? The logistics of closing something like this. So the fact that you were able to kind of shut down any facility like that of that size in just a few days is almost unheard of.
Right, and the only thing that was holding us back was Bagram. They said, where are we going to put, you know, close to 200 people? Like, where are we going to put these guys?
Right.
And that, I mean, we would have gone sooner, I think, if they would have had space. And so they told us they showed us a map of, it turned out to be Camp Warrior, which is supposed to be the temporary, not permanent facility of Bagram. It's like the temporary area.
Yep.
So you go in there, you hang out for a few days, and then you push out to where you're going to be operating out of. So that was going to be our home away from home.
Sure.
So already a bad feeling. But they showed us a map of Camp Warrior, and they said, listen, this section is 2-4 infantries. It will be ready for you. You're going to work here. You're going to sleep here. You know, this is your life support. And we showed up, and it was completely scrapped. We went into the buildings, and suddenly there were, like, all these weirdos in there. There was contractors in there. There was Air Force in there. There were local Afghans setting up shop in there. So, I mean, we had to adjust pretty quickly. At first, we were in these things called the circus tents, these aircraft maintenance hangars.
Yep.
Where there's just like a sea of bunk beds, you know? And then slowly we were able to clear out room in the chews. I'd never lived in a chew up to this point, the container housing unit.
Yeah.
And it was pretty nice, I'm not going to lie. But we tried to make sure that we had a battle buddy everywhere we went. So my battle buddy was always Peter Anderson, you know, class of 2008 here at West Point. And, you know, we worked in the same building, we slept in the same building. And we made space for our unit, and all the while we're flying out or driving out to advise these Afghan army dudes or the Afghan police, watch them on their operations.
So did you stay at Bagram the rest of the deployment?
Yeah, we moved to Bagram, I want to say early to mid-October. And then by the end of October, you know, that's only a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it felt like we were like into our steady state operations already. Hiccup. You know, we got past it, the hurdles avoided, got back into the action.
So you're now, let's fast forward to December 1st. You've been there and for a month and a half, kind of doing your job, but doing it with a commute now, essentially, right?
Yeah, well, so we had, and it's so frustrating, when we went, if we go by air to any of these locations, it's fine. It's pretty quick fly. It's preferable. It's relatively secure. Sometimes you can't get the air transportation, and so you have to drive. And so we wouldn't drive with the Afghans. We weren't partnered like that.
Mm-hmm.
We were partnered in the sense that, hey, we're going to show up and then do our mission with you.
Yep.
So whether it was at Fob to Gob or whether it was out of Bagram, if we had to use the trucks and drive down there in our Max Pros and our MRAPs, that was a serious movement. I think the longest drive was 6 hours once. And that was just straight U.S. forces with interpreters, and we were on the road going to and from. And the move to Bagram, I think it cut down because there were so many routes that were black that you couldn't go down, that the Afghans either didn't clear or had never cleared, so we're not going to go down them either because that's not our mission, is to clear these routes for them. But I think the move to Bagram shortened one leg of our trip and made the other one longer. So the only benefit of moving to Bagram was this force protection idea.
Okay.
So we still did our mission. We were still rocking and rolling, advising regularly. Did a couple big missions with the Afghans, a couple of clearance missions with the police. So everything seemed to be steady state going into November. And that's when I kind of slipped into this, you know, we like to be into habits, we're creatures of habits. So I slipped into this mindset of, all right, if we're not actively advising, you know, in person with our Afghan counterparts, well, I'm a staff captain, so I've got staff captain stuff to do. I have to do this regional RASR report talking about all the warfighting functions, how we're helping the Afghans and where we assess them. So that's a big movement. And so I'm doing that, coordinating with our staff to make sure we're assessing them properly. That's pretty much all day.
Sure.
And into the night, that's when I started getting most of my work done, because that's when my cycle lined up with the higher headquarters people. And then after we get off, because my buddy Pete Anderson kind of transitioned to nights as well, that's when we would start working out and getting after our own personal stuff.
Sure.
So kind of slipped into this nice steady state operations on Bagram.
So then what happens on December 1st?
So December 1st, right? So a week prior to December 1st, we're in one of our sync meetings. We have like sync meetings every 2 to 3 days. And during one of them, there was an initial report that there had been looters in our own motor pool. And our sister units on Bagram have similar grievances, talking about, you know, is it the MPs? Is it these other units? Is it probably the Afghans that are working on Bagram? Because there's thousands of people on Bagram. And what they're doing is they're cutting up the side of the fence, make a little door, go in there, steal fuel cans, steal tools, whatever. I think one was so brazen as to steal a generator, like a small two-man carry generator, like, you know, big ticket items. And so that kind of bothered me. I never encountered that as a platoon leader in RC South. You know, never encountered that during my Merchant Marine days. Never encountered that at Tagab. Like, we didn't have any of these problems. And we had Afghan contractors on Tagab, too, but never had looters that we know of. And so get to December 1st. I asked Pete Anderson the night before on the 30th. I said, all right, you know what's happening tomorrow? We're both training up for Ranger School. We had these like lofty ideas of going back to Ranger School together. And probably the biggest weed out event in Ranger School is the RPFT. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not that bad. It's usually push-ups that get people. Maybe the people don't want to be there. They don't actually do the push-ups. But our focus, because we're getting huge on this deployment, we're getting swole, is we actually do a 5-mile run. Mm-hmm. You go do it in an 8-minute pace. You know, normally Fort Polk life, that wasn't a problem. Afghan life, starting to be a problem. So we're forcing each other to do this stupid 5-mile run. And but the first thing we do is we get our lift in. That's key.
Yeah.
And so that night on the 30th of November 2013, Pete says, he's just had a rough day and into the night, didn't sleep well the night before, you know. I think we'd just come off an advising mission the day prior to that even. And so he said, you know, I'll catch you. We'll get a second lift in during lunch. You know, and I don't think it was a lift that was a problem. I think it was the running. Everyone doesn't like to run. Running kills gains. So I say, you know what? I'm not going to argue with you on that. I understand where you're coming from. I'm still going to do it. And so, I mean, you're on Bagram. You're not even allowed to, I mean, you have a weapon, but you're not even allowed to be green status. You're like even greener than green status. You know, you have to have a magazine. It has to be like away from your weapon. Yeah. Can't have a round chamber, like nothing like that. So a lot of folks will even go to the gym like we had been doing without even bringing a weapon, because the chances of encountering someone where you need a weapon is far slimmer than forgetting you have a weapon and then leaving it in the chow hall, in the gym, in the latrine, and then showing up on Army, you know, WTF moments.
Sure.
So we stopped even bringing our weapons to the gym. We would just go slick. You know, the one thing that we had to have was our reflective belt and our iPro.
Safety first.
Sergeant Major McAllister, all-American badass. Like, if he saw us without iPro, I mean, he didn't care what your rank was. He would like, crush you.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're, like, legitimately afraid of him. So, go to the gym, got my iPro on. Don't even bother taking it off because it's clear iPro anyway. Don't even notice it anymore at this point. And get a good lift in, and then start my RPFT. And by that point, I think it's like 3:30 in the morning, so pretty early in the morning. And what was kind of weird about that night, and it's just like a coincidence, all these things happening, is before I even went to the gym tent, is I ran into our other advising team, the police advising team. Which was led by Captain Adam Napier. He was our Delta Company commander. And saw him in the shower bathroom tent. And he's like, yeah, we're leaving in a mission in like at 05, 04:30. Oh, no, not 05. Like 02. It was really early, like really late at night, really early in the morning, however you want to look at it. We're leaving at this ungodly hour so we can drive at night, avoid any traffic, have a nice smooth ride up to their advising site. And, you know, I high-five him, tell him good luck, and they're driving. They can't fly because they just didn't get the request in soon enough or whatever. It wasn't available. And so while I'm lifting, I'm not thinking about his mission, not worried about his mission. But when I'm running, I start my five-mile run, I get this weird feeling, and I'm thinking about him leaving the motor pool and the briefing that we had talking about the looters. And I'm trying to do this correlation between these two events happening where, you know, unit leaves the motor pool, then they get looted. Why? Well, probably because when you leave the motor pool, you're worried about getting on the trucks and getting in the right order and then actually leaving and not running over the gate, not running over any of the light poles, the big stupid vehicles on these little tiny roads, and then like maneuvering your way out of Camp Warrior. And I've seen it twice up to this point where the gate is unlocked, one time left wide open. So now you're just asking for someone to come in there and steal everything that's not nailed down.
And just to be clear, this is the gate from the motor pool out onto the rest of the fob.
Right. Yep. Right. So yeah, so we have our own little tiny motor pool that's really far away from where we work and live. It's still within Camp Warrior, but there's like a separate parking lot of these fenced in motor pools that are all kind of clustered together.
Okay. And so if that gate is open, that means that besides, you know, several thousand Americans from different services, contractors, you have other coalition partners, and a lot of local nationals as well, Afghans, all of whom now have access to that motor pool.
Right. So what's to stop them from walking in there?
Sure.
It's very poorly lit. There's a couple street lamps. Most of them are burnt out because, again, this is a very was supposed to be a very temporary thing, and then they were supposed to shut down Camp Warrior and Bagram. It's not nice like the French fob that's going to be there forever. So I get it in my mind that, you know what, I'm going to check this out. I'm going to go check out to see if they actually locked the gate and see if anything's going on over there. So normally what I would do is I'd run around the gym area, and it's about a third of a mile, so you can imagine 15 laps of that isn't, you know, the best. But going out to our motor pool in a round, it's about a mile and a quarter. So if I mix these two things together, and I'm just trying to do my math department math over here, I can come out to about 5 miles and knock out, you know, looking at the motor pool and feel better about myself.
Sure.
So I do that. I start out, I do my normal laps around the gym area, and then, you know, get onto this gravel path, and I'm heading out towards where our motor pool is, and I get out there, and sure enough, I see that not only is the gate closed, I can tell it's closed, but there's someone standing in front of it. And he's wearing traditional kind of like the contractor garb. He's got like the loose baggy pants. He's got the shirt that comes, you know, past his knees. Not really wearing any headgear that I could tell.
When you say contractor, local
Afghan, local national contractor. Yeah, local Afghan national.
Okay.
Military age male. I can't really make anything out, still pretty far away, but the sound of my feet crunching on the dirt and the gravel alerts him to that someone's approaching, and that it's like probably close to 4 o'clock in the morning, somewhere between 3 and 4 in the morning. And he was facing the gate, and that noise startles him, and so he turns around. And mind you, there's like nothing around here.
Yep.
This is like a thoroughfare to go from one part of Fob Warrior to another. There's no reason to be hanging around here. Mm-hmm. Nobody works here except for like mechanics.
And it's also 4 o'clock in the morning.
Really early in the morning.
Sure.
Or late at night, whatever your flavor is. And so I get up close to him, and I do this thing that I kind of learned in this hokey school I took part in. The Marines used to call it the Hunter-Killer Program. The Army stole their idea, and we call it ASAT, Advanced Situational Awareness Training.
Sure.
It's when you're taking the training, it's very hokey, and like the instructors are really into it, and they've completely bought into this heuristic thing. And I never thought I would be appreciative of that school and be thankful that I took it. Because the hackles, I got hackles on my neck and all up and down my arms. Everything about the situation looked wrong, felt wrong, smelt wrong, everything. And that was enough of an indicator for me to do something about it. So I kind of slowed down just enough to try and get a good look at this guy. Everything was nondescript. He was probably in his late 20s, maybe early 30s, Afghan years. Might have aged him a little bit more, so maybe in his early 20s then.
Sure.
Maybe even younger than that. And then as I'm running past him and I look down, I notice he's wearing tennis shoes. Never seen the local contractors wearing tennis shoes. So wearing tennis shoes, and then he's staring at the ground, doesn't even look at me, doesn't even glance at me. He's just looking at the ground like this, just staring at nothing. And I kind of sail on past him. And then come to the end of our front of our fence, of our motor pool, turn to the right, and I keep running. And at this point, my pace is completely trashed. I have no hopes of passing the 5 miler at the required 40 minutes. And so my mind isn't even worried about that. I'm thinking about this guy. And I give myself about a 30-second count, and I'm counting to 30. And what's going through my mind is, what can I do? And so I think of three things, and I roll two of them out almost immediately. The first one I thought about was, I should probably tell the MPs. Well, there are no MPs here. They're all up in this place on Bagram called Disney. Mm-hmm. That's where they live. That's where their office is. That's where all the important people are. That's the permanent part of Bagram.
The good side of the tracks on Bagram.
Right. They only come to Camp Warrior to give out speeding tickets during the day. Yeah. They don't come there to patrol at night, clearly. So that's ruled out. If I tried to even run that far, I would kill all my gains, and then I would... It would probably take 40 minutes, honestly, to get up there. And by then, convince them that they have to come back with me. And by then, this dude is long gone.
So what are the other options?
The other option is to go raise the alarm. Find the nearest building, bang on it, get some help, raise the alarm. Someone calls a number. I don't have a smartphone that has international at this point, even though it's 2013. I wasn't with the program yet. But, call the number to get the sirens going. And my... that might have been the best choice given what came next. But I didn't do it because of fear of embarrassment. Like, if this was a looter and you're raising the alarm that wakes up the entire Bagram airfield base, you would never live that day.
Yeah, you're going to be that guy every time you walk into a room.
Right.
Yep.
So, nope, not that. So, one dude, I can handle this. So, I'm going to turn back around. I'm going to... run past him again, and then turn back around, run past him again. So what I'm thinking about doing is yo-yoing around him until he either gets the picture that I'm focused on him and make it awkward and engage him, or stop and actually talk to him maybe, human-to-human interaction. Could be.
Sure.
So I turn back around. As I'm running back, it's a chain-link fence, and you can kind of see through it. Mm-hmm. And so as I get towards the corner, I can see that he's turned around again and he's got the lock and chain in hand. And so that changed my decision. I decided, instead of spooking this guy, he's actually trying to get into our motor pool. And so I round the corner and I might be big at this point. I was about 240 pounds, pushing 250. I was getting pretty huge. But I still had some sprinting power in me. And so I charge full on at this guy. And as he turns his head to look at me, which is pretty much as soon as I turn around the corner, I yell, "Wadarega, Astada Show," which is stop in Pashto and Dari, respectively. And
how did you know that?
Oh, as a platoon leader, alone and unafraid. I had my own cop in RC South, so... Had three interpreters and went on patrols 1 to 2 times a day. And so I learned.
So you picked up all the handy phrases.
Oh, yeah.
Including that one.
I tried to learn as much as I could.
Okay.
I was very fascinated with learning a second language other than Spanish.
Sure.
So used a little bit that I remember from a couple years prior to like tell someone to stop in no uncertain terms.
Yeah.
And he turns and runs. So for me and my, you know, infantry warrior mindset, I take that as an act of guilt.
Yeah.
So I don't decide to like murder this guy. I decide to stop him.
Yeah.
And I stop him with the only thing I have, which is my, you know, probably more than 2 times body weight. And I just crash into him. And we go to the ground. And I'm on top, so it's like sandpaper for him. You know, they just, he just slides, and I'm kind of like using him like a sled at this point. So we go to the ground, and I'm at this point in my life, I'm pretty good at combatives. And so I flip this guy around, and he's squirming too. So it's not like I had to manhandle him too bad, but he kind of shrimps around to where his head is up and he's trying to get away. And then he's not yelling out or anything. He's like a professional.
Mm-hmm.
He's silent. He is struggling. He puts one of his hands up against underneath my chin and moves my head to control my body. And everything about this felt odd. Like I was fighting a professional, like a soldier. But he had his hand clenched around something. And what he had his hand clenched around, I thought was maybe, you know, maybe our keys to the motor pool, or maybe, I don't know, something. And then I had this growing fear. And I mean, this is all happening within seconds. I thought, you know, what if there's a wire going down his wrist?
Mm-hmm.
What if he has a clacker? Because from Sergeant Major McAllister's previous unit, I replaced them as a platoon leader. They had suicide bombers left and right. Some of them had clackers between their knees.
Yeah.
Some of them had them hidden up their wrists, and they just had to like turn their wrist a certain way and kind of flex their arm. I mean, all kinds of weird stuff. And so I had this paranoia kind of unfolding in reality in front of me. And my first focus was, well, if he's going to control my head, I'm going to control his. So I put a hand on his face, holding him down. And with my other hand, my left hand, my non-dominant hand, I grab his right hand, and I peel back the fingers. And what comes out of there, I thought it was going to be something else. It was he had 3 very professional grade, almost akin to our blasting caps.
Oh, wow.
And it's just one shocking realization after another. I'm suddenly very aware that I'm on top of him, and I'm turning my mind to my thighs and my chest that I'm like kind of bearing down on him with, and there's bumps everywhere. So obviously suicide vest. So no clacker, so hidden clacker, I don't know. But he's got some sort of armor or vest, fishing vest, something on underneath, LBE, you name it. And I have no idea what's in there. But all around me, as I kind of push back off of him, because for a split moment, I thought I was going to get up off of him and jump back, and then he was going to explode. And I didn't do that, because as I pushed back, I saw that there was even more stuff on the ground around him. It was like when I hit him, he was a clown car, and everything just came out of him. All kinds of stuff. He had multiple cell phones. There was a couple spools of this twin flex wire, this really thin wire that they have that we always found with like command wire IEDs. Just all manner of like IED making material. He had wiring tools that were slipping out of his pockets. I saw the lockpicks. He actually had an actual set of lockpicks, you know, so not your run-of-the-mill looter.
So you're seeing all this stuff. Are you still engaged with him?
I still have a hand on his face as I'm pushing back, looking around my thighs, trying to see if I can see anything else.
Yeah.
And it's when I kind of see this array of this buffet of IED-making materials that I decide, you know, the best thing to do at this point to prevent him from clacking himself off, if that's in the case of what's going to happen here,
mm-hmm.
Well, I'm just going to take away that choice. And so my hand slips down from his face to his neck, My hand lets go of his other hand, which he then slaps to my neck to try and, like, pull me away. And I put two thumbs over his Adam's apple and push all the way until I can't push anymore. And that's when he starts trying to call out. I have no idea what he's calling out. It wasn't Pashto or Dari. It might have been someone's name. But it felt like the crushing of one of those bendable straws. That's what it felt like, crushing his throat. And pretty sickening feeling, but it was a tactile, audible indicator that I had ended another human's life, effectively. And I held him there for a few seconds, long enough to where he was gurgling, and kind of, I felt his hands kind of going slack and kind of falling off of me. And that's when I heard crunching of footsteps. And so apparently what he had been calling for was help, because if I had chosen a different path to run down, if I had, instead of running past him and turning right, if I had turned right immediately, that path down the, as you're looking at the motor pool, the right side of the motor pool was completely unlit. It was dark. And I've had eye surgery once before. My night vision's not great natively. And so what was down there was a bodyguard. And this guy was about my size. And instead of your, you know, typical Pashto Afghan, this was like a Hazara, I think. He looked a little bit Mongol, maybe Russian. And he was pretty big. He was a pretty big dude. And I guess I got pretty lucky. He took a large pipe, about 3 inch in diameter, and it was lead with a, they found the actual weapon. And they struck me across the head on my right temple and opened me up pretty good. Thankfully, I had iPro on. So it shattered my ESS crossbows. The lens broke in half, and the arm of this thing had like a nice gouge taken out of it. So that kind of made it a glancing blow instead of a direct hit when this guy took a baseball swing at my head. Kind of blacked out after that. Didn't take that hit too well. And came to, it felt like seconds, could have been minutes, came to, surveyed the area, they were gone, they're ghosted out, didn't see any of their stuff that was on the ground, you know, no lock picks, no blasting caps, no cell phones.
So he took the other guy's body as well.
Yeah, I didn't know at the time, I didn't know what had happened. I knew that I had really severely injured someone. And then his buddy clocked me. And when I came to, I looked for them. That was my first instinct, was we got to re-engage. I'm going to get this mofo, you know. I'm going to get back at him. Mm-hmm. Didn't see him. And then I noticed, you know, back then we had the gray PT shirts. Blood on the shirt, blood on my legs, blood all over my hands. Touched my head. It's burning hot. I don't know how long I've been there. It's still dark, so it's not daylight yet, but the sun is kind of cresting. You know, it's the BMNT. So I said, you know, I got to get help. We got to find these guys. We got to do something about this, because I have no idea what they were doing. I can only imagine. And so beeline it for where I think is the direction of the nearest barracks building in it, or at least either the circus tents where people are living, or the chews, and the chews came first. I just kind of, by muscle memory, wound my way back. And the first set of chews happened to be where I lived. So that's really lucky. I have no idea what my door code is. I still don't know. So our chew is the third in this little row, and I am banging on it. And Pete is still sleeping, and we have multiple roommates, but Pete and this chaplain are the ones that answer the door. And his look turns from annoyance to complete horror when he sees me in this messed up state of disrepair. And as soon as he gets me in his arms and I tell him, there's two, they're still over there. It's like the worst gatwa that I've ever given someone. You know, I at least gave him like enemy size, right? I tell him there's two. I think I told him they're at the motor pool and they're attacking us. You know, not the best instructions, but enough to get him moving. I don't even think he was like in his underwear. I don't even know if he had a shirt on. I don't even know if he had shoes on. And he was gone. And I was like, well, I'm just going to lay here. But the chaplain was there. Mm-hmm. And so this chaplain has me. I have no adrenaline. Adrenaline's completely dumped. And as he's talking to me, this chaplain is like holding my head and talking about my, I guess in the light of, I don't know if it was getting lighter out or if there was a lamp or something, a street lamp underneath the chews. He's like talking about the color of my eyes. And then I have just this, the whole world starts to shake. And I had, you know, my first ever seizure. Wow. And completely seize. And I pass out again. I wake up again. And it's daylight, I think. And there is everybody around me. That's like my battalion commander, Paul Cunningham, Colonel Cunningham. Major Trevor Volkel, my S3, my XO was an S3. Like, all these people are around me, and they're, like, strapping me to a backboard and putting me into an FLA, you know, to get medevaced. And then I have another seizure. And they're like, oh, my gosh, he's seizing. And they put me into the LMT, or the FLA. They put me in the back of the FLA. They don't secure me, and they don't close the door, and so the medic takes off, and guess what happens to me?
Oh, no.
Fly out the back.
With the backboard? Are you strapped down to the backboard?
I'm strapped to the backboard, and at this point, like, I can't feel anything. I don't even know where I am, and I'm not even sure if I landed, you know, face up or face down. I'm not sure. I just remember everyone's yelling. People are just like, just, you know, foaming at the mouth, yelling at each other. There's like an alarm going off now. So someone raised the alarm, I guess. They get me back in the FLA and they shoot me over to the hospital. The last thing I remember is they got me on like a roller cart. I'm still strapped down. And I see a doctor. I guess there's other people around me, but I see the one doc and he's like trying to put something over my face. And I don't know why, I probably should have let him do what he had to do, but I grabbed his arm and I squeezed it so hard that I thought I broke it.
Wow.
And then I had another seizure and then I was passed out. I think I went into a coma for 2 days. 1 day or 2 days? I have no idea. And after that, everything up until I get to Longstuhl, it's from people, my battalion surgeon, Major Volkel, Colonel Cunningham, it's people telling me what had happened after that.
So you were evacuated after that?
Right. I went to Longstuhl. When I came to in Longstuhl, well, from what I remember in Longstuhl, even though I think I was awake in the hospital at Bagram, my memories are really weird. They had me on like Keppra, I guess, which is like an anti-seizure drug, which messes you up pretty bad. But I don't remember the flight to Longstuhl. I just remember getting to Longstuhl. The doctors, there's three different doctors, didn't know why I was there. It was like there was no information, nothing. They didn't even know where I like what country I came from. They thought maybe I was a local at JMRC that got hurt. Maybe I was in AFRICOM. Maybe I was in Iraq. Like, they don't know where I came from.
Okay.
No information. And I just remember like going through recovery there and then finally piecing it together. And so the initial report was that I'd been attacked by looters. One report was that I got attacked by a fellow soldier. One report was that I got mugged by some local Afghans. You know, they were trying to rule everything out.
Did they ever figure out what did happen?
So it took a year. CID did their investigation. And so what had happened is big dude, big Hazara guy, took his boss's body, who died right there, and fled. Gathered up everything he could, which was pretty good except for the weapon he hit me with. Gathered up all those pieces, took the body, and ran to what he thought was an abandoned section of either Camp Warrior or even some other part of Bagram. Turns out it wasn't abandoned. So when the alarms went off and our security company, Apache Company 2-4, was like, they got into trucks and on foot, and they were like prowling for anyone suspicious looking, you know, they were getting after it. That alerted the people in this compound to come out and check out what was going on. Turns out it was the CIA compound.
Wow.
And so the story that I've been told is that one of the agents or one of the workers there in the field office steps out, looks around, looks over to the dumpster, and sees Hazara squatting there, acting totally suspicious. And then next to him, it's like a Weekend at Bernie's. Dead guy, like slumped up. And so he kindly pulls them in and figures out what the heck happened. And then there was this very distinct divide in information flow. So CIA's got their dudes. We had nothing. So the CID investigation, they had nothing to go on. They just had injured Tyson Walsh. You know, I've got what I remember of my story.
But otherwise, they never found these guys, so they're just phantoms.
Right.
Yeah.
So the CIA publishes a couple things. They send to the 10th Mountain, G2, and to the division commander, General Townsend, and then to our brigade command and staff down at Fort Polk. They send them a couple of documents, one of them being basically an exum of everything that happened, what they did. So they said on December 1st, you know, Captain Tyson Walsh engaged and killed this guy that turns out to be a sub-commander for the Haqqani Taliban network. It turns out it was a weird translation. They said it was the son of Sirajuni, and it turns out it's like one of his random nephews or something.
Okay.
They get these relationships mixed up.
But a prominent figure.
Prominent figure. Big deal. And his bodyguard, they didn't name him. So what happened is they took these two, body and not, you know, living and not living guy, into custody and plugged the Hazara for information. And because his boss got schwacked, and this guy, the bodyguard, is not only supposed to keep his boss alive, but is also not a Pashtun.
Mm-hmm.
He's Hazara, which is a subclass. If he goes back out on the street, he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he has shamed his people. He has shamed his organization. So he says, whatever you do, don't let me go. And he tells them where six of the other commanders are that staged this attack, that were part of this ongoing operation. They get six jackpots, all good information in exchange for this guy's, you know, safety and life.
Wow.
And what had happened was the operation that they uncovered was just shy of 2 years in length. So at December 1st, 2013, that had roughly the 18-month mark. And what they were doing is smuggling onto Bagram IEDs, planting them in motor pools, anywhere in ECPs. I think they said they found one under a latrine. Anywhere that they could, they were burying IEDs. At this point, they said there was close to three dozen in various states of readiness. Some of them, there was just a jug there. And this is all from the Hazara guy's, you know, his recollection of mm-hmm. where everything was. Some of them were completely set up, remote, and the cell phone already fully charged and ready to go with a battery connected to it to keep it fully charged, ready to receive a signal. And their plan was on some significant day, Christmas that year, I don't know, Easter, Eid, Ramadan, whatever, on some day in the future when HQN could decide that we're going to detonate all these things, cause mass chaos, because they know these IEDs probably wouldn't cause casualties, but I think they were fixated on vehicles. They wanted to disable the vehicles because those are, you know, big money items. And then they had a couple hundred fighters, mostly suicide bombers, that they were just going to flood Bagram with and inflict mass casualties.
Wow.
And this is completely dismantled by one idiot running alone against all better judgment. You know, should have had a battle buddy, should have had a weapon. I don't know, still, you know, mucked up their plan.
It's an incredible story.
It's lucky, really lucky.
You know, another way of looking at it is that there are probably a lot of people, you know, walking around now who are lucky that you happen to, you know, be trying to lower your runtime so for the RPFT that night at, you know, ODARK 30. What did you call the Marine Corps program? Hunter Killer?
Yeah,
the Hunter Killer. And the Army calls it
the Advanced ASAT, Advanced Situational Awareness Training.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that seems to be a theme that we get in some of the episodes as people talk about training that kind of, you know, you sit through and you might even roll your eyes or something. But just by being present, you're sort of like...
Well, they took us out. They took us out into the field. And so they'd have these mock training houses, and some of them would be completely sterile, nothing wrong with them. And then you'd go into a house and it would smell like cat piss, ammonia. You're like... That's really weird. And then they would stop the scenario, and these like wannabe 18 series guys would come out. These like, I don't even know if maybe they're AWG or something. These wannabe cool guys would come out and they'd say, all right, guys, pause scenario. What do you think is going on here? You went through three houses. You said this one smells weird. What do you think? Like, I don't know. It just smells weird. It smells like chemicals, like ammonia. Well, what is ammonia used for? Oh, ammonium nitrate aluminum. You know, there's an IED facility here, like a serious one. It smells like cat piss.
Do you think if you hadn't gone through that training, that night might have gone differently?
I think so.
Well, could you ever have imagined that this is, you know, you were an infantry officer, you'd trained for combat. Could you have ever, but you had also done combatives, but something about when you're doing combatives, it sort of has more. It's not just training you to fight hand-to-hand combat. It's training a mentality. It's physical training. It's a lot of other things. Could you ever have imagined that this was something that you would experience?
No, not even a little bit. I told my wife. So my PL tour was very kinetic, very stressful. We were in good old 166 armor. We were in combo blackout for. I mean, weeks at a time, almost the entire deployment. It was so incredibly stressful
because
for
our families. Casualties.
For casualties.
Yes. For listeners that aren't aware, you know, when there are casualties, you go on combo blackout just so that the families can be notified through proper channels.
Yeah, right.
And so if you have a lot of casualties, that means you're on combo blackout for an extended period of time.
Yeah, it was desperate. That deployment felt back home like it was a desperate situation, very dire. And so when I came home and, you know, we moved to Fort Polk and chose that location because 10th Mountain was on the patch chart. We were supposed to be the last battle space owners in Afghanistan, not this advising mission. When it turned into the advising mission, I told my wife, Jennifer, that, you know, I'm a staff officer. I'm an advisor. This is like the most cush job ever. Completely low threat. Like, I could just get rid of my life insurance right now, save us a couple bucks every month. Yeah. You know, these are the conversations I had with her, and then come to find out that I was 8 hours away from having a uniformed person and a chaplain knocking at my door at Fort Polk to tell my wife that I'm in a coma and might not, that I'm critically injured in combat. 8 hours.
Uh-huh.
And that just... You know, it just shows you the volatility of war. You know, you just don't know what's going to happen.
Well, Tyson, thank you very much for sitting down and telling us, like I said, a really unique story. One of the things that I've really appreciated in recording these is that there's no two combat experiences are alike. This is certainly one that highlights the extent to which that's true, because this is very unique. So thank you very much for sharing the story with our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.